A return to rodeo and the return of live music. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, June 16th, and this is In the Moment. We're continuing our June spotlight on rodeo in South Dakota with the story of J.C. Hubb. The rodeo athlete from South Dakota State University has qualified for nationals 5 times, and this year returned from an injury that kept her out of play for months. SDPB's Jenna Scott has the story. Plus, the Dakota political junkies talk a new executive director for the South Dakota Democratic Party, and Beau DePena takes the stage at Levitt at the Falls on Friday. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Billionaire philanthropist Mackenzie Scott is making big gifts to groups supporting Native Americans. Scott formerly worked for Amazon and was married to company founder Jeff Bezos. She's giving $6 million to the First Peoples Fund in Rapid City. The gift is one of hundreds she's sending to organizations around the country. Stuart Huntington has more.
Lori Poirier has been working for decades to bring positive change to Native communities and knows firsthand how difficult it is sometimes to find funding.
I've been doing this work more than 25 years in Indian country, and for the past 20 years or so, less than 1% of all philanthropic dollars have gone to Native causes and concerns, and that has not changed in the last 20 years.
Poirier calls the donation from Scott transformational and hopefully an indication of progress.
I'm just deeply, deeply, deeply grateful for this gift because it really allows us to gives us that time to breathe and continue the important work in tribal communities.
On Tuesday, Scott also made gifts to the Thunder Valley Development Corporation on the Pine Ridge Reservation and the NDN Collective in Rapid City. Most of her donations, including to First Peoples Fund, come with no restrictions. For Oglala Lakota citizen Poirier, that means her fund can keep doing what it does best, strengthening Native communities through culture and arts.
There's a whole bunch of more people we can help, and there's a whole handful of communities we could deepen our work in. You know, on Pine Ridge, we've been working with the Lakota Funds and the Lakota Federal Credit Union now for a very long time. We have the Rolling Res Arts Bus that's gone some 37,000 miles and worked with over 1,000 artists. So we're going to really be able to do this good work, and pretty excited about it. And just again, just like, can't believe what's just happening, right?
Groups that benefit from First Peoples Fund's work say that preserving ancient traditions helps strengthen communities today. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Stuart Huntington.
Governor Kristi Noem has indicated she will try yet again to hold a fireworks display over Mount Rushmore to celebrate Independence Day this year. Her request comes on the heels of President Joe Biden's announcement that the White House will host its own Independence from the Coronavirus celebration. However, even if the National Park Service reversed its decision to deny the state a permit for fireworks, the state would struggle to pull the event together just weeks before Independence Day. The South Dakota Democratic Party has a new leader. Burke Ehrmantraut will begin his work as the party's executive director on June 28th. Ehrmantraut was a campaign staffer for former gubernatorial candidate and South Dakota lawmaker Billy Sutton. He succeeds Pam Kolm, who resigned from the position earlier this year to work on expanding Medicaid in South Dakota. Ehrmantraut is a Beersford native and has most recently been working as a senior digital communications manager at Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. For weather today, sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s northwest to the lower 100s for areas of central and eastern South Dakota. The National Weather Service is set to issue a heat advisory for portions of central and most of eastern South Dakota later this afternoon. We're still seeing a wind advisory in effect for much of the west. On Thursday, sunny skies west with a chance of showers and thunderstorms by the morning. In the northeast, mostly cloudy, but will gradually get sunnier. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Jackie Hendry in today for Lori Walsh. More than 50% of the state is currently impacted by severe drought. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist, and she joins us now with an update from Aberdeen. Laura Edwards, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you, Jackie.
So there are several different levels of drought. People hear drought, they think it's dry, but no, it's more than that. Help us understand the levels of drought and how they're reported.
Yeah, so one of the main things that we use that is every week updated on Thursdays is the U.S. Drought Monitor, and they range from abnormally dry, or what they call D0 category, up to D4, which is exceptional drought. We don't have any D4 here in South Dakota, but we do have D3, which is something like 3 to 5 times in a century level drought, and right now that's in the north central part of the state. The severe drought you mentioned is what they call D2. That maybe happens about 5 or so times a century. So, certainly we're seeing some very extreme or even rare type of drought right now.
Wow. In those areas that are under that, say, severe drought warning, what does that actually mean for what's happening on the ground? How do we see that impacting people's lives?
Yeah, we've seen it a lot of different ways. Some of this drought started last year in the summer and fall, and some of it has newly emerged really just this year. So we're seeing some long-term impacts and short-term impacts. So one is on the crop side, on the plant side, we're seeing some corn starting to roll their leaves, hay being cut early because it's drying out so fast, some more insects in alfalfa, and water supply for livestock on the agriculture side. But also on the impacts, we're also seeing things like recreation be affected. Saw a story yesterday of a kayak business in the Sioux Falls area that's having some struggles due to low water in the Big Sioux River. Game Fish and Parks is having to move a lot of their boat launches to adjust to low water levels, especially on the Missouri River. So it's starting to affect a lot of different areas of the state and a lot of different industries.
Wow. And you mentioned with a couple of these designations, these are, 3 to 5 times in a century that we see this level of drought, which I really want to highlight because that made my jaw drop when you said that. When we look at other periods of South Dakota facing drought or more intense periods of drought, how does this compare what we're currently seeing to some other extreme cases?
Right now, one of the recent things that's happening is we've had some extreme heat the first 2 weeks of June, and we're starting to break records that have been holding on since the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, 1933, and then more recently 1988 also was a very hot June. So in addition to the dry conditions, we're also seeing heat, which really makes things much, much worse in a hurry. So, as far as, the North Central, where it's the worst right now, they have had some recent very bad drought in the 16 and 17 years, 2016 and 17. But Sioux Falls, southeast area, they were worse in 2012, according to our climate data and what we've seen on impacts on the agriculture side. So we've had seen some worse droughts in some parts of the state, but others are really seeing some very extreme situations.
So give us another overview, if you would. We kind of introed with that about 54% of South Dakota in that D2 severe drought, also some extreme drought in some cases. Whereabouts are we seeing a lot of that drought indicated?
Sure, yeah. The worst area right now is the north central part of the state and up into North Dakota, our friends to the north. The northwest started out really, really tough in the spring season, but since then, the last month or so, they've gotten a little rain, so they've improved, but they're still holding on to some moderate to severe drought. The area that's getting gradually worse, especially in the last month, is probably east of the Missouri River, right along the central, the southeastern corner of the state. We've seen some gradual declines or worsening of the drought situation. So I think we're keeping an eye on the eastern part of the state more now than the west at this point.
In kind of our closing few seconds, what is there any way to make any kind of prediction from what we're seeing right now to any relief on the horizon?
It's kind of tough to make up ground now. You know, we've kind of starting to pass our wettest time of year, which is month of May in the west and June in the east. You know, our water demand is about an inch every 5 days right now. So it's going to be hard to catch up ground. I think we're going to be holding on to drought for much of the summer, unfortunately.
The latest U.S. Drought Monitor maps are released Thursday mornings. You can find them at www.drought.gov. SDSU Extension State Climatologist Laura Edwards helping us unpack what we're seeing now. Laura Edwards, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, we continue our spotlight on rodeo in South Dakota with the story of J.C. Hupp's return to the arena. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state. Informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Howlett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. The National College Finals Rodeo is underway this week in Casper, Wyoming. J.C. Hupp is a rodeo athlete from SDSU who's qualified for nationals 5 times. This year, she came back from an injury that left her out of the arena for months. SDPB's Jenna Scott talked with the Hupp family before the finals.
On the Broken Arrow Ranch, J.C. Hupp practices for hours to prepare for national finals. J.C. and her horse French Fry have a specialty event, goat tying. Rodeo has always been a family affair for the Hupps. J.C. is the youngest of 4 siblings.
My father did it. My mom was around horses her whole life. My older brother and sisters went to SDSU and rodeoed, and so it's kind of just been something we've always done.
But an accident several years ago in a rodeo arena left J.C. seriously injured. In 2018, she lost much of the use of her right eye.
And I ended up having my head rope stretch and snap back at me, and people that were there said it sounded like a gun going off. It stretched so far and snapped so hard, and it hit me right dead center in my right eye. And we didn't really know what was going on right away. It was so big and swelled up, and I couldn't even open it, let alone know if I could see out of it.
J.C. and her family saw multiple Sioux Falls specialists before getting treatment in the Twin Cities.
We found out that I had quite a mess going on in there, and there really wasn't much to salvage.
J.C. had to wait 9 long months until she was able to get the surgery she needed for her damaged eye. The medical procedure included a new technique to insert a hand-painted iris. In fact, J.C. is the first person in South Dakota to have the procedure. Her parents were with her every step of the way. Her father, Bill, says it was hard to watch his youngest daughter be in such pain.
Oh, it was devastating. It was it's probably, I felt worse for her, you know. She loved it so much and was having some success at it and stuff, and then to just have it just like that.
But it wasn't long until JC was back in the saddle and out in the arena. Her mom, LaDonna, remembers JC's first rodeo after the surgery and the emotions that came with it.
Of course, we were there, and it was nerve-wracking to watch her run go, and knew that her depth perception was off and that she would have blind spots, and just, she did really well. And then after that, I just didn't really worry about it too much.
For a family that spends more time in their arena than in their living room, rodeo is a staple, and JC is grateful to her parents who have helped her throughout this process.
I would not be where I am at all without them, between the horses they put me on, the trailers they've given me, the fees they've helped me with when I couldn't afford them myself, I can't practice by myself, and they always just say, yep, we'll stay out there as long as you need whenever I want to practice. So I'd be a fraction of what I am without them.
The challenges she's faced have helped JC place less emphasis on the competition and more on her teammates.
I've met my best friends at college rodeoing specifically. How many people can say they can hang out with their niece every night doing stuff like this? I have an incredible bond with siblings because of it, and my parents, you know, I owe my parents the world because of what they've done for me and how much time we spent together.
JC's parents will be with her again as she goes to Nationals for the fourth time. The College National Finals Rodeo runs all week through the 19th. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jenna Scott.
J.C. Hupp tied for 12th in goat tying at the National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association Finals. You can find and share this story online at sdpb.org/news. In other rodeo news, Kadoka cowboy Dylan Riggins was seriously injured at the National Finals when the horse he was riding ran head-on into a wall, reared backwards, and rolled directly on top of Riggins, breaking his collarbone and ribs and bruising his lungs. Riggins is in stable condition and is expected to make a full recovery. Riggins competes for Southeastern Oklahoma State. Up next, the South Dakota Democratic Party names a new executive director. Dakota political junkies Tom Dempster and John Schaff help us unpack the latest. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, executive director of SDPB. The Sound Vision campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
We spend a lot of time in our newsroom thinking about the past and how context can help us all understand the present. Right now, we're thinking about our past because NPR is celebrating 50 years of reporting. We've come a long way, and we're grateful for this moment and for listeners like you who have made it all possible. Thanks for being there then, now, and next.
SDPB, proud to be South Dakota's NPR station for 50 years.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Democratic Party has a new executive director, again, and three supervising officers with the U.S. Marshals Service are facing criminal charges from a judge based in Aberdeen after a deputy refused to share her COVID vaccination status. The Dakota political junkies bring their perspectives to today's show. Joining us by phone from Aberdeen is John Schaff, professor of political science at Northern State University. John Schaff, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you, Jackie.
And across the table from me in the Kirby family studio in Sioux Falls, we welcome former state senator Tom Dempster. Tom, welcome to you as well.
Nice to be in the studio. This is a delight.
It's wonderful to make eye contact with people for the first time in about a year. So let's start with this change of leadership from the South Dakota Democratic Party. Burke Ermentrout, he's a Beersford native, former staffer for Billy Sutton's gubernatorial campaign. But of course, hard not to notice this is a fairly fast turnaround for the party's executive director position. John Schaff, I think we'll start with you. What's your sense of the state of the Democratic Party in South Dakota based on these leadership changes?
Well, as I think we all know that the state of the party is relatively low at this point. You know, in voter registration, they're behind Republicans by well over 100,000 registered voters. And, you know, and there has been over the last, I don't know, let's say 5-6 years, there's been sort of a merry-go-round in leadership of the Democratic Party within the state. Partially because, you know, they aren't very many elected officers of the Democrats in the state. They hold no statewide offices, so there's no natural leaders. So you look to these sort of administrative leaders within the party apparatus as opposed to elected officials, and they've had a hard time keeping people there. So I guess we'll see if Burke Ermentrout, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, can sort of, I don't know, break the curse, so to speak, or set a new trend. And sounds like he's got some experience raising money, and maybe can help. The party's had some money issues, maybe can help raise some money. And then, you know, of course, the main thing is trying to convince people that they need to be voting for Democrats. We'll see if this kind of change can help the party become just kind of managerially or administratively stronger and more consistent than it's been over the last handful of years.
Tom, what's your sense in responding to John?
Well, I might, as a Republican, I might be a heathen Republican here, Jackie. But I've always believed, as a former member of the legislature, when you're closer to 50-50, it's a better game. The legislature is all about ideas, all about conflicting ideas. Maybe no difference than a football game. And if you've got a two-thirds majority on one term on one team and a one-third on the other team, it's not an even match. And that sort of legislature, by my take anyway, does not produce the best ideas, does not produce the best legislation. Someone just told me this morning that when you get started, you're 50% done. So the new chair of the Democratic Party, I think, has just gotten started. That means he's 50% done. There's a long road ahead, but it's a necessary road and an important road. And for sure, with the Biden presidency, the Democrats have a lot to say, and they certainly have a lot to sell.
Mm-hmm. John Ermentrout was part of course, the closest gubernatorial race in recent memory for the Democrats in South Dakota. How do we see this new executive director counting for something there when we're looking at such a Republican supermajority in the state house, and then we're coming up to, we have yet to hear a confirmed challenger for Kristi Noem for the next gubernatorial race?
Oh, I don't have any doubt that plays part of the decision-making process. As you say, Billy Sutton, someone correct me, got, 47-48% of the vote, somewhere in that ballpark in the last gubernatorial race. So that's doing pretty good. In fact, it's doing outstanding for a Democrat. Even better would have been to win. And so the extent that Burke Ermentrout had something to do with that, and knowing how to talk to various constituencies. And obviously some of that vote that got Billy Sutton, not quite over the top, but close, what meant that Sutton appealed to at least some Republicans and a good percentage of independents. And that's what, when I talk about the voter registration gap, if Democrats are going to be successful on a statewide basis, obviously there are localities they can be successful, but on a statewide basis, they need to appeal to some Republicans and some independents. And maybe that's part of why he's got the job, and maybe looking forward of all the statewide races next year, maybe they're looking at the governor's race somewhere where they can make an impact. Although Kristi Noem is formidable, there's no doubt about that. And as you say, the Democrats don't have a candidate yet, but maybe you got to do the best you can do, and maybe this is the best they can do, and give them the best shot at winning some races and winning some non-Democrats over to the Democrat side.
Yeah, I'm remembering back to our last gubernatorial race and Billy Sutton's running mate, Michelle LaValle, a party registration change to get on the ticket and win over those independents and maybe more conservative folks. Tom, when you're looking ahead to the next gubernatorial race and imagining a possible match for Governor Kristi Noem, are there any names that spring to mind as people toss out their possibilities of what this might look like?
Oh, I don't know, Jackie. I mean, today I think that's a little bit like eating popcorn. I mean, it's fun to salt it a little bit. It's fun to add a little bit of butter. But I think that's about the extent to what it is. For sure, there's going to have to be a serious candidate in order to take on Governor Noem for sure. I mean, when you win an election, that's a big deal. I mean, I'm still experienced enough, shall we say, that I remember the front page of the Argus Leader when Tom Daschle was first elected, I think, to the House. And I think he won his election by 87 votes.
Wow.
Well, ultimately, he then becomes a United States Senator, and then he ultimately becomes the leader of the Senate. Oh, what a difference just 87 votes make. So I'm not so certain that it makes a big difference how close the Billy Sutton Noem race was. Mm. She's certainly done well with her popularity, certainly done well with her notoriety in the, 8 years in the House and now 2 years in as being a governor.
Mm-hmm. John, do you agree with the popcorn metaphor we have in the room here? Anything you want to toss out in that idea? Because I also can't help but think even this state election will certainly have quite a bit of national attention considering the last year we've had. So, John, what are your thoughts?
I might go with Junior Mints, but you guys choose whatever treat you want. But no, I think Tom's exactly right. The notoriety that Kristi Noem has, I think, some obvious benefits, so that's not really worth commenting on. Maybe, though, there's a potential there. Because, one thing, Tom invokes Tom Daschle, and one of the things we've seen this over, half a century or so of South Dakota politics is sometimes South Dakotans don't like it when their politicians get a little bit too big for their britches. And maybe it's eventually what ended up doing in Tom Daschle and others, like George McGovern, for example, or Larry Pressler, maybe, is you get involved in Washington, D.C. stuff. Or in case of Kristi Noem, you're involved in kind of national presidential politics, at least, that discussion about it. And sometimes the people of South Dakota, they don't like that. Now, I would not in a million years, bet against Kristi Noem, quite the opposite, because I say she's formidable. But it just there's at least something there that you could see a Democrat exploiting, but that requires the Democrats to put up a credible candidate, and in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, that's been difficult for them on the gubernatorial level. At least, certainly over the last, not counting Billy Sutton, when I just think of Governor Dugard and Governor Rounds facing, in most cases, relatively token opposition. So they're going to have to up their game a little bit in candidate recruitment.
Tom, any closing thoughts before we move on to our next topic?
Well, sure. I mean, John is right. I mean, candidate recruitment, I mean, you need resources. I mean, I don't know why I'm using sports metaphors because I'm not a sports metaphor guy. But you kind of build a team and build a team and build a team and build a team. And then over a long period of time, you actually start to win. And I think that analogy with respect to building legislative candidates who have experience and have been there for a long time and can actually win state to national elections isn't something that you just flip on a switch and say, oh, we've got it. It's a long-term process for sure.
Hmm. Well, as a Cubs fan, I'll tell you that metaphor strikes true. You know how that goes.
I gotcha.
So let's move on to our next story. This one out of Aberdeen, a conflict between a federal judge who's requiring everyone in his courtroom to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 and a U.S. Marshal who would not disclose her vaccination status based on the Marshal Service's procedures. John, you're near the action there. Of course, there's more to it than just vaccination status. Kind of bring us up to speed on what we're seeing with this intriguing story.
Yeah, I'm sitting here only a few blocks away from where the action is going down, I suppose. Well, it's really a remarkable story in that our federal judge up here, our district judge, Charles Kornman, who's a Clinton appointee, so you can see, Judge Kornman's been around a long time and I think is fairly well respected in the community and among the legal community. But he had this incident in May, as the courts have really started getting up and going, where there's a federal marshal who the judge asked the marshal's vaccination status, and she refused to answer, and he kicked her out of the courtroom. The next thing you know, marshals are taking some prisoners, and you know, they're leaving the courthouse, and Judge Kornman has held various people, including the head of the Marshal Service in South Dakota, one of the top marshal executives in Washington, D.C., is holding them in contempt, including criminal contempt. He's threatened to fine them $5,000. He's accusing them of kidnapping these prisoners when they left the courthouse. The marshals left the courthouse with their prisoners without telling the judge. There are two things that are of interest of this. One, you have a real separation of powers issue of who gets to tell the federal marshals what to do. Does the judge get to tell the marshals what to do, or do the marshals get to tell the marshals what to do? Because, of course, U.S. Marshal Service is executive branch, and so their boss, ultimately, is President Biden. And the judiciary doesn't get to tell executive branch people what to do. On the other hand, Judge Kornman is basically saying, it's my courtroom, and if I want people to tell me their vaccination status, they have to tell me the vaccination status, whereas the Marshal Service has demurred on requiring that. The other thing is, if you read some of the news accounts on this, if you guys down in South in Sioux Falls, south of here, are detecting a bit of a breeze of self-righteousness coming in from the north, that might be Judge Kornman, who maybe is going a bit overblown and maybe is asserting more authority over his courtroom and taking some umbrage at some things that maybe he just needs to let go. But we'll see, because it's going to be interesting to see how it goes down, whether we have other courts, higher appellate courts, come in and maybe discipline Judge Kornman a little bit, which might be what's needed in this instance.
Tom, what are your initial impressions as this story unfolds?
Well, Jackie and John, I want to tell you that we in the Deep South here in Sioux Falls, yes, always defer to wisdom from the North. You've always known.
I know that's not true, but I'll take the compliment.
Let me step back from the brouhaha and tell you what really really concerns me more than anything else is how in the world have we here in the United States for one second allowed those things that save lives, such as masks or such as the vaccine, become politicized? I was talking to a good friend of mine a couple of days ago, and we're talking about vaccines and stuff like that, and all of a sudden he looks at me and he says, well, I'm not vaccinated, and neither is my wife. He says, we refuse to be sheep. And I stepped back from that, and I hold our political leaders responsible for selling their own political futures based on making that conception that it's an elite thing as to whether or not you wear a mask. It's an elite thing whether you get a vaccination. I consider that to be outrageous because these are reasons why we've had 600,000 deaths in the United States and over 2,000 deaths in the South Dakota. That type of philosophy, that type of political machinations cost lives. I think it's outrageous.
And it's unsurprising, perhaps, that this story is capturing national attention as so much COVID-related or even tangentially COVID-related news in South Dakota has. The Washington Post and other national outlets taking up this story. And it's a point well taken. These are politicized elements that are intended from a healthcare perspective. And now these things are playing out in surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, political ways. As in kind of our last couple minutes, John, as you kind of watch this play out, how do you expect this instance to kind of bleed into conversations in other, I guess, places of employment? Are we surprised that it's a courtroom where this is really hitting the fan, as it were?
Well, here's where, you know, Tom and I keep agreeing with each other today, so we have to stop this. We'll have to find something we disagree about. But I think what Tom's right about is this, that it's analogous to all sorts of decisions that we have to make. I think at the university level, there's, you know, controversies at various universities about whether they can or should require the students when they come back next fall to be vaccinated. We in South Dakota have decided that it's not going to be a requirement. As I understand it, and I might be wrong about this, under federal law, because the COVID vaccines were fast-tracked as an emergency and didn't go through all the FDA protocols that they normally would have, you can't list it as a mandatory vaccination. And that's how I understand it, is that there are legal difficulties there. But this is what we're playing with, is how much do we demand of people to be vaccinated or masks for public health, as Tom indicates, and how much do we defer to people's own judgment or their own individual choices? And this is a conflict I think is going to come up, certainly as vaccinations a large numbers are vaccinated. This conflict of public health versus individual rights is something we've experienced over the last year. And we think as the pandemic seems to be winding down, we'd be getting over this stuff, but maybe not. And this is, I think, the conflict that's playing out in Judge Korman's courtroom up here, is what are this balance between people's legal rights, public safety, their individual rights, and then, position of who makes these decisions is something that is going to come up over and over and over.
We'll have to leave it there. The time always flies for the Dakota Political Junkies, a weekly feature here on In the Moment on Wednesdays. This week, our guests, John Schaff, professor of political science at Northern State University in Aberdeen. John, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And former South Dakota State Senator Tom Dempster. Tom, thanks to you as well.
Great. Thank you, Jackie.
After sitting dark for 4 years, the lights are back on at Huset Speedway, and the roar of engines fills the valley along Split Rock Creek in Brandon. Todd Queering purchased the track from Chuck Brennan last year, and he has Huset Speedway's calendar full of big races this summer, including the upcoming Royal River Casino Night and the Huset's 50, which takes place Sunday through Tuesday. Justin Henderson of Sioux Falls is just 3 points out of the lead in the 410 Outlaw Sprint Car Division. We take a moment with the 2002 Huset's track champion as he reflects on his life at his hometown track and how he's happy to be able to race there again.
We're very excited to have Huset Speedway open again and have it under, great ownership. Chuck brought it along and kept it going and made the facility into what it is, but without Todd and of course, Doug Johnson and Greg Baker, the guys there that are doing all the work right now, I don't think that we would have what we have. You know, we're fortunate enough that they decided to put the banking back into place. That's made a huge difference for the racing. You know, professional racing, it would start with my dad. My grandpa, the amount of racing he did would have been, you know, more so along the lines of on the back roads, kind of running down the gravel and racing each other back then with the old Fords and whatnot. Let me put it to you this way. I don't ever remember wanting to do anything else. So from the time that I very first saw these things at my dad's shop, which was a garage that was connected to our house, you know, very well organized, small little garage that had his 83 car in it, his original 83 car. I can remember working on that thing. When I was Maximus's age now, my boy is about the age that I was when my dad started racing. So it's super important for me to make it a good experience for Maximus like my dad did for me.
That's 2002 Huset Speedway track champion Justin Henderson, who took a moment to share his elation that the track is open again. Huset holds races 3 nights straight beginning this Sunday. After the break, we hear from Levitt at the Falls headliner Bo DePena. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state. Informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Hallett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear alto saxophonist Jim Snedero recorded live at the Deerhead Inn, the latest from guitarist Dan Wilson, and vocalist Frida Payne in duet with D.D. Bridgewater. Plus, there's local music by saxophonist Brian Hennigan and a classic track by Horace Silver. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
You used to wake me with your kisses. You kept me going with that smile. Squeezing and hugging just before breakfast. Then fool around for a while.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry in today for Lori Walsh. Well, the sun's setting a little later, the temperature's rising, live music is back in town, and so is Bo DePena. The Colorado-based singer-songwriter's latest album is called It's About to Get Western, and DePena headlines Friday's free concert at Levitt at the Falls in Sioux Falls. Bo DePena joins us now to talk about his latest work. Bo, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I gather there's something a little different in this upcoming show on Friday. You've got a host of other musicians joining you on stage. Tell us a little bit about what to expect from this show at the Levitt.
So this show is definitely going to be far more electrified than any of the other shows I've put together in Sioux Falls, and I'm really excited about that. It's typically just me and an acoustic guitar, but this time I'll be bringing my electric guitar player Lance Ruthie, my bass player Ronnie Allen, and my drummer Andrew A.J. Knight. And I myself am also going to be picking up the electric guitar every once in a while and doing some kind of lead work as well. So it's going to be really electrified, lots of energy, and hopefully lots of fun. I think it will be.
We opened the segment with a clip of the song Second Cup of Coffee from that new album. What can you tell us about that song?
So that song was co-written with my friends from a band out of Houston, Texas called Western Bling, and they're a Western swing band. And when I had the idea for the song a couple of years back, it finally came to life with this band. And we recorded it during COVID all separately, all from our separate homes, and it just came together and felt so natural that I was compelled to invite them into the studio for a full record. And that's what it turned out to be, is to get Lester.
Wow. I don't know if artists are getting tired of being asked, how did the pandemic impact your work? But to me, it's an interesting question, so I'll pose it to you. What was the relationship between the pandemic and your process making this album? Was this a bit of escapism for you, or was it a way to process what was going on? What was that like?
For me, it was honestly a way just to get back together with musicians who I deeply admire, and being able to finally get back into the studio in mid-April, which is when we first went in, really was a rejuvenating feeling for me. It allowed me to kind of reconnect with the fact that this is my passion, my dream. And it gave me the sense of, you know, it kind of reignited my ambition and also my drive to really excel and do better. And I'm just so thrilled with the way the album turned out. And fortunately for me, I always kept in touch with fans and the people that had been supportive of me throughout the years, including venues, radio stations, blogs, et cetera. And so as soon as this record was out, I was able to really get the word out about it, and then to also book a whole summer of shows of, you know, venues and people that were waiting to see me play live again. So in a lot of ways, I actually got a lot of leverage from taking a little break during the pandemic and then coming back in full force.
I want to read a little bit from an album review on the site, Saving Country Music. I really liked this little segment where the reviewer says about you, he sings what he lives and lives what he sings and hopes the world catches on, but he's not about to catch the disease of the modern hustle to make that happen. And that comment is tied a little bit with your decision earlier this year to leave certain social media platforms that a lot of folks would think you, quote unquote, need to have as an artist. Put that decision in context of taking a little bit of a break over the past year and focusing on this music.
Absolutely. I think what I've learned over the years is that there's a lot of things that we glorify, certain metrics and certain stats that we look at with regard to social media, that even though they might give us like this little burst of dopamine that we feel is important, at the end of the day, what really matters, in my opinion, is going to be the connections you make with the people that you meet in person, and showing them that you're not just a musician and you're not just trying to throw a product at them, but that you're also an individual with a life who also has needs, cares, desires. And that one-on-one interaction that I get with people that show up to my shows is really what fuels me. And to realize that a lot of the social media and kind of the glorified metrics were just a distraction for me. So I decided that I really wanted to focus on developing the real relationships out in the world, not just digitally.
Mm-hmm. So is that Western sound, how does that play into some of that, I guess, I hear you say kind of seeking that authenticity in those relationships and in your music? How do these sort of classic Western sounds that we hear in this latest album fuel that in your mind?
Well, I think it's interesting. As a musician, you go through various phases of your life where you're exploring what music really resonates with you. And over the years, as I've gotten more involved in country music and really start to admire lyricism, I started to discover people like Merle Haggard and Jennings, and that they would often be backed up by musicians that had maybe a jazz background or were highly proficient in music in ways that most people don't give credit to country music. And being out West has allowed me to get in front of fans and people that are highly appreciative of that. Also, it's just more congruous with what my lifestyle is, which is being kind of an outdoorsman, a fisherman, a hunter, and somebody who just loves being out West and in the mountains. And that's, I think, what he was getting at when he was saying the authenticity. It's like music and my own personal life have seemed to confluence over the years as I've discovered playing more country and Western music. And it's been a growth process, one that I'm very grateful for and one that I'm very happy to be continuing.
And we do have the title song, It's About to Get Western. Let's take a listen to this song.
Riding brim to brim from the ranch to the rodeo. Tommy draws him a wild one, a little bronc they call Smokey Joe. Well, Smokey Joe, he ain't never been rode, and Tommy ain't never been throwed. As he settles into the bucking chute, he says, boys, here comes the show.
It's about to get western around here tonight. You better wear your working clothes and pull your hat down tight.
That song, It's About to Get Western, from Bo DePena. He headlines the next Levitt at the Falls concert coming up on Friday. Bo, tell us more about that song. I hear the rodeo connection and just so happens to fit with our SDPB month spotlight on rodeo. Tell us about the process of writing that song.
So that one was actually written by a few people, one of them being Mike Blakely, and it was first released by a Texas country musician named Gary P. Nunn. And the reason that that particular song resonated with me was because since I started touring the Mountain West, coming from Texas and then touring the Mountain West, I had never heard the term getting Western. And apparently it's kind of a Western slang way of saying it got real rowdy in a bar. So I first heard that after playing a show in Montana, and I thought, man, that's the coolest phrase I'd ever heard. I just thought that's really catchy. And then driving later on in that tour, a song by Gary P. Nunn comes on, It's About to Get Western. And I said to myself, I have to record that song someday. So it just fit in so well with what my touring life had been, what my musical life and my musical journey, and it was going in the right direction. And then being that I knew these friends of mine from Houston, Texas, who were Western swing musicians, I thought, what a great excuse to write an album that is themed off of the Mountain West, and not just by songs others have written, but my own tunes like The Ballad of Rat Creek, El Camino Lounge, Colorado Rose, a lot of them talking about being kind of in the mountains of Colorado.
Bo DePena headlines this Friday's free Levitt at the Falls concert in Sioux Falls. His latest album is titled It's About to Get Western. Bo DePena, thanks again for joining us today. Always appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Pick Sloan Missouri Basin Program, authorized by the Flood Control Act of 1944, provided flood control, irrigation, power generation, and water recreation opportunities. Those benefits were supposed to be shared by all, but the loss of culturally significant lands fell on Native tribes in Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Dr. Rosie Sprague is an instructor of American Indian Studies at Black Hills State University. Her presentation, Water Management and Cultural Loss, the Pick Sloan Missouri Basin Program, is part of this week's Festival of Talks at BHSU in Spearfish. She joins us now with a preview. Dr. Sprague, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So there's a history here of hundreds of thousands of acres of land submerged by various dams around this region. And that history can be really surprising to people who, even though they may have lived here all their lives, haven't heard that piece of the story before. How do you introduce this topic to your audience?
I introduce it basically by just exactly what you said. It's a broad overview of the Pick Sloan plan when it began. Basically, why it was introduced was to reduce flooding of what we call the Big Muddy, right? And these major floods occurred from 1844 to 1934. And so this plan was introduced by Colonel Lewis Pick. It was a very short plan, about 12 pages long, and then construction began in 1948. And so that is what we know, and of course, goals of the project were hydropower, irrigation, recreation. That is what we know on paper, but the history of the Pick Sloan plan and how it affects our Native communities isn't as well known as we hope it would be, especially for those of us in South Dakota and those of us who grew up on the river, right? If you're from here, if you're from Robidge, South Dakota, you've grown up on the river, recreation, all that was fun, but we don't really know the true history of what was lost due to this Pick Sloan plan. And so basically I cover that broad overview of the plan, and then I really get into the tribes who are affected and what was lost.
Right. And tell us a touch on just a bit, what was lost when culture is so tied to land for many of these communities?
Sure. So the main things of what I'm getting into is the loss of culture. And when I say culture, I mean things, plants, the flora and fauna of the areas, land that was used for ceremony, the bottom lands, which were the lands that were taken. And I get into why I use the word taken in my presentation as well. But our medicines that we use as Native peoples, and a lot of these medicines can only be found in these specific habitats, and many of which were flooded. Medicines that were used for health, for ceremony, cemeteries, our burial grounds, which were also affected by the flooding. A lot of those come to find out years later that some of those were never moved, which were said that they were going to be moved. And so a lot of that was heartbreaking to find out later for our people, to see their relatives not being taken care of. And also, you have to look at economic resources that the bottomlands brought to the people, fishing, hunting, timber that was used for homes and for firewood. So all of that you have to think about when you think about what was lost. It did not only affect them economically, but culturally, spiritually, all of those things are taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, proponents of this Pick Sloan program saw these million acres of irrigation as an appropriate compensation for those things that were lost. But how have we seen that program play out over the years?
Well, some of the things that were promised in the beginning were hydropower, promises of hydropower to the tribes, promises of irrigation to the tribes, which many of the tribes have not seen any or at all real irrigation, solutions for the people. The tribes have been compensated by funds from the government. But when you really dig deep into the amount that was given to the tribes, it was really not that much. And they were given, if not even half of what the acreage would have been worth. And so you can look at it like, yes, there are benefits to the project. Yes, it reduced floods. Yes, it gave us recreation and irrigation for some, but in the long run, we're still reeling from the effects of the Pick Sloan plan. Today in 2021, our tribes are still reeling from those effects. One example is of the Fort Berthold Reservation. It said at the time, before the program first started, about 6% were living off of government assistance. And after this happened, after the bottom lands were taken, a lot of the economic activities were taken, that number shot up to around 90% being on government assistance. So you can see how much of an impact it had on the people.